And as promised, either a few seconds ago or whenever you listened to part one, here is part two of episode 51 of the Phoenix Suns podcast here on Bright Side of the Sun. So I guess 51 and a half, or however you want to call this podcast. But we went with Dave King earlier, talking his shenanigans in the All-Star weekend, as well as a lot of different subjects ranging from Gerald Green to the way the Suns are playing and et cetera. So if you want to go back and listen to that one, go ahead and jump on it. But to kind of set the table, we are going to be doing this one here now with Jim Kochenour with slightly better audio quality because he's not in a car driving home from the arena. We're going to jump on, talk a little bit more extended with Goran Dragic being an MVP candidate. We're going to dive into some Facebook questions. So you ask them, we will actually answer them. And then talking about the obvious subject of the week and of the day, specifically today, the trade deadline. Jim Kochenour, it's been a while. That's my fault, but we're back. We're here. We're podcasting. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. It looks like we saved the best for last tonight, and I was figuring the audio quality was going to be better due to the tones of my mellifluous voice, not necessarily just a car type of thing getting in the way.
Well, there's potential with that, but you know what? It's, you know, saving the best for last, or, you know, actually recording this in the just the niceness of a home, maybe in front in an office, maybe away from people or away from horns and turn signals. Dave, you know, wink, wink. But, you know, he was driving home from the game, jumped on, started talking. We're all troopers here. You know, Dave jumps on and talks after he gets home from the game or while driving home. You jump on and talk just, you know, inches before midnight here and getting this out to the people before the trade deadline is actually final. So if people have some stuff to listen to maybe here in the morning here on a fine Thursday. But let's not ramble too much, too many pleasantries here. Me and you don't have a lot of pleasantries. You know, we usually bicker back and forth, even though on the podcast we agree way too much. But let's jump into something that me and you, I think, both agree. Me and Dave touched on this a little bit. I mentioned some of my stats and some of my rationale. But let's talk Goran Dragic, let's talk MVP, and let's talk about some of the stuff that you've been digging up that actually put him on a great list, and then also put him on a great Mount Rushmore potential list as well.
Yeah, a lot of people had been coming up with their own stats to kind of represent the type of season Dragic has and put that in a positive light, and it has been a tremendous season for him. But I kind of did my own digging, and I put this up in my weekly Going Gorilla segment, and what I kind of found out was I took his points per game and his true shooting percentage and his win shares for 48 minutes. And the point of that, kind of moving that all together in that triumvirate, was showing that he was a uber-efficient volume scorer, and then also with the win shares that plays into that, but kind of all-encompassing in his overall efficiency and what he's contributing. And so I compiled a list of the other players in the NBA who had achieved equal or better numbers in those three categories combined. And the list I came up with was Wilt Chamberlain, Michael Jordan, LeBron James, Kevin Durant, Charles Barkley, David Robinson, Magic, Karl Malone, Kareem, Kevin McHale, Adrian Dantley, Amari Stoudemire, Bernard King, Brad Doherty, and Dwight Howard. And right there, that's a pretty impressive list. That's a bunch of Hall of Fame NBA players, some of the best ever. And what was even more impressive was when I threw in his 6.2 assists that he's averaging, and then changed the search engine based on that criteria, then the group of five became Michael, Magic, Wilt, LeBron, and Goran.
That sounds about right. I mean, it's got a nice ring to it when you have Goran there at the end of it, especially after saying Magic, Michael, Wilt, LeBron, and then Goran. So Goran is the guy that's like, with the Mount Rushmore, he's got his paint strokes, or maybe he's waiting in line, you know, behind a nice velvet rope. He's the only one in line standing outside of that Mount Rushmore while those three guys are getting their faces immortalized on a mountain, basically.
Exactly. He's trying to crash the party. I guess the recent discussion was whether LeBron was actually in there on the outside looking in. I heard some pretty contentious stuff. It sounded like Bill Russell took offense to a little bit of umbrage to the fact that he wasn't listed on as many with the I guess he was thinking that the titles kind of trumped everything else. But, yeah, so I guess on the outside looking in, some of the people that kind of felt slighted, we'd have Bill Russell, and then Goran would be standing next to him because he's knocking right on the door of that group with his numbers.
Well, you know what, Bill? If you want to get onto this list, you got to start dishing out more assists. You know, I know you're a very unselfish player. You won a lot of championships, and you did pretty much everything else on the court, but if you want to get on this list, you got to dish out about 3 or 4 more assists a game than what you did. It's just, it's the reality of the fact you're on about 50 other Mount Rushmores. So let's let Goran have this one. Let's have him waiting outside the velvet rope there and kind of appreciate what he's doing. And, you know, I was talking to Dave that take away bias, you know, and I know that I caught a lot of flack for coming out of the closet, so to speak, is saying that I'm not or never was really a Suns fan. I'm a writer and I live in Phoenix and I'm covering the Phoenix Suns, and hopefully objectivity is something that some people appreciate. A lot of people don't, though. If you take away bias and you just look at the scope of the NBA and you understand how it works, and depending on what your definition of an MVP is, I mean, Goran is one of the guys, one of three players in the entire NBA, to piggyback on stuff that you were saying there. He's only one of three people in the NBA that is scoring at least 20, dishing out at least 6, and is shooting over 50% from the field. The other two are the clear, far and away best two players in the NBA, or in the world, Kevin Durant and LeBron James. So when you look at it from that perspective, not just the stats, but how many wins do the Suns have if they would have panic-traded Goran early? Or if how many wins would they have if Goran's ankle never fully healed up well and he ended up missing a couple of weeks versus just a couple of days like he has? Those are the kind of things that you got to start looking at. I mean, yes, you can say that every team has their version of a Goran who, if you take them off, they lose wins. Like Kyrie Irving off the Cleveland Cavaliers, maybe they have less wins, but then again, they don't have very many to begin with. Goran Dragic is the engine that runs the Suns. He's the guy that does pretty much everything that's asked of him and plays at a high level, at high pace, at high energy every single night. And he's doing some things that nobody else in the NBA, frankly, is doing. Not Chris Paul's not doing these things. You know, Tony Parker's not necessarily doing these things. Their teams are winning, and those guys are great in their own right. But Goran, just in this individual season, is arguably one of the top point guards in the NBA, if not, I know some people have made the argument, the best point guard in the NBA this season. And we're talking about an individual, isolated season, guys. So let's not start going crazy and saying that we're saying that Goran is better than Chris Paul long term, after this season, previous seasons. We're talking about one isolated season, and that happens from time to time where guys have a career season, and that's what Goran's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the things you were touching on there in terms of indispensability to a team, I think that the Suns would take as big of a setback as nearly any team in the NBA if you subtracted Goran from the roster, especially with what's happened with Bledsoe. He has just completely put this team on his back and carried them through this. Now, LeBron and Durant, I think they're in a completely separate category in terms of that MVP race. So it seems like it's the two of them and then everybody else to a certain extent. But I think if you look at the guys past that point, if you look at everybody not included in those top two, then you can really make a case that Goran is pretty close to anybody else in the conversation with some of the stuff, with time that people have missed, with Russell Westbrook, Chris Paul missing significant time. You take guys like that out of the picture. Tony Parker hasn't had a great year, and he's hurt now. You have Stephen Curry, who's still having an amazing year, and some of his raw numbers look a little bit better with the points and the assists. I think he's close to like 25 and 9. He's having a really great year, and those raw numbers are really good. But it doesn't necessarily translate to, you know, some of the efficiency type of stuff that Goran has posted, and the Warriors obviously are just, you know, a little bit behind Phoenix in the standings, so his play hasn't translated into bigger success. LaMarcus Aldridge has fallen off after he seemed like a really strong candidate earlier in the year, and he's got to share some of that spotlight with his teammate Damian Lillard. You have Paul George for the Pacers that should still be a strong candidate. And really, so Gorin, you can make a really strong case that he is somewhere in that top echelon, top five, maybe somewhere around there. You can make the argument.
Yeah, and the only, and I'm glad you started randomly listing off people there without being prompted to and giving rationale. The only other player that's missing that I would say, I think there's the group of two at the top, and then there's the group of five just below it. Steph Curry, obviously, LaMarcus Aldridge, Paul George, those guys for fairly obvious reasons, team success, career years, the things that they're doing on the court. And then the last one, in my opinion, this is just me talking out loud about indispensability and, you know, the way the teams are playing. There's only like three teams in the Eastern Conference that can legitimately say, hey, we have an MVP candidate. The rest of them just, I don't care how good your season is, you're not allowed to talk when you're 3 to 20 games under 500. It's just not really allowable. But the other one is Dirk Nowitzki. I think with Dallas and Phoenix were both projected as bottom five teams in the NBA this year. And granted, a lot of it has to do with Monta Ellis and, you know, Jose Calderon and the play of, you know, the team as itself. Rick Carlisle is one of the most underrated NBA coaches, I think, that has ever coached the game. The guy's phenomenal. But I think that Dirk Nowitzki deserves a lot of credit for Dallas being where they're at, with basically being right now one game under 500 and being right there in the thick of it. At one point, we're ahead of the Suns and then, you know, lose a couple of games. But I think that those five are, you know, they round out, you know, the 3 through 7 spots or 3 through 8 spots in the MVP conversation, in my opinion. And Gorin, you know, it doesn't matter where you put him. I personally would say that he's probably at the top of that group of five, but he can slide anywhere between there depending on team success, who's winning, who's not winning, who's higher in the standings, whatever rationale and definition you want to use.
Yeah, another person I was just thinking of that isn't on the list and basically just based off the way his team is playing but is also putting up the good raw numbers is Kevin Love, who is still in stasis waiting to be liberated from Kevin Garnett's former prison. So he would kind of maybe be in the discussion there. With Gorin, the discussion to a point, it's good that he's kind of been acknowledged in terms of at least being in that conversation, even if it's on the far end of the outside of the conversation in most arenas. But what I was thinking is actually that with his progression through the season and with the Suns continuing to move in the right direction, his strong play, and he's traditionally a much better second half player, so he builds up momentum as the season progresses, that hopefully some of this will maybe garner him a third team or second team All-NBA selection. I think that would be a really good tribute to him for all the play come into the season.
I think so. I think that would be, and not only just that, but he also plays well in the second half of games, and he's a ball of energy, and that energy usually ends up playing out well. I'm going to just personally, this is just me on the podcast, they have to be unanimous decisions for them to go through. So not saying I have more power than you, but just the simple fact that you said that you think that he is one, and I'm just going to say that he's not one, it just voids the fact of Kevin Love being, he's in that Tracy McGrady all-star pantheon of guys that put up tremendous numbers that don't necessarily translate to wins. We'll see what happens if he gets to play next to an all-star caliber player eventually in his career, like when Tracy McGrady did. He made the playoffs and, you know, they did decent, you know, never really getting past that first, second round realm of things. But yeah, I just personally, I can't put Kevin Love in an MVP conversation. I don't think he impacts winning. I think that he does a lot of things that lead to statistics but don't lead to necessarily team success.
Fair enough. The other thing I think that kind of hurts Gorin in a way with all that stuff too is that, like I mentioned with Stephen Curry with the raw numbers and what he puts up posts that way, Gorin's assist numbers are a little bit low. And for what most people, when they're thinking point guard, they're thinking somebody that's going to be 8, 9, 10 assists. So just by changing that number, it would really instantly legitimize a lot more of what he's done. And that's a problem with the team. The team has been at the bottom of the league in assists per game, lots of those numbers all year. And I've mentioned before that I think it's a little bit ironic that one of the nicknames for team's best player that's last in the league in assists is the one-man fast break. And Gorin leads the team in fast break points. I think I heard him say that he's averaging the most fast break points on the team since Jason Richardson. And he does that all on unassisted plays. He creates the steals, he creates the turnovers, and he runs down the court and just takes it all the way to the hole. And so one of the things, it's, you know, kind of a chink in the armor in terms of the recognition that I think he deserves is that's one of the causes right there.
Now, to continue on a little bit with the Minnesota question, or the Kevin Love talking about Minnesota, let's talk a little bit. So we had a couple of Facebook questions, and one of them has to do with seasonal standings, and Minnesota's not, I don't know, Minnesota and Denver, in my opinion, aren't playoff contenders. They're talented enough, I guess, to rattle off maybe 8 out of 9 or 9 out of 10 or something like that and get themselves in the conversation at some point, but I think with the way they're playing, being under 500 at this stage of the season, I don't necessarily see them being a contender, even if they did get hot for that stretch. That's, you know, a little bit too late. A lot of L's in that sentence. Sorry if that sounded weird. But one of the Facebook questions was about standings. It came from Trevor Paxton, and he said, of the four teams that seem to be battling it out for the final playoff spots there between Phoenix, Dallas, Golden State, and Memphis, who do you think makes it in, assuming everyone stays healthy? So obviously, you know, playing the health card, not assuming that someone's going to get hurt. But of those four teams, Dallas, Memphis, Golden State, Phoenix, he said who's going to make the last spot. I think that maybe it's, you know, which of those four doesn't make it, because I think three of the four will make it based on the standings today. What do you think about that, Jim?
I think that Dallas is the odd man out. Memphis has really made a push since Gasol rejoined the team, came back from the injury. I don't know what their exact record is since that point, but they've been playing really well, and they've made up a bunch of ground, and they're knocking on the door right now. So I see them continuing that upwards trajectory, and I wouldn't be surprised if they end up actually even in the sixth seed. Phoenix is going to finish up with a really tough stretch of a bunch of road games, I think like 14 out of their last 21. And with Memphis continuing upwards, I think I saw something that they have more road games than any other team, but they also have the lowest winning percentage of their opponents. But a lot of, I think they have a bunch of easy road games, you know, road games against teams with records below 500.
So they're basically playing the East. They have a lot of road games, but they get to go to Eastern Conference teams.
Right, that's probably what it is, and for them, that's not even like a jet lag type of situation or anything like that, because they basically play back there, so they're maybe an hour off of their time zone, something like that. So those should be easy for them to clean up on the doormats. And Golden State, I think they've got a little more substance to their roster, a little bit more talent, so. Like you had kind of mentioned Nowitzki before, if they make the playoffs, it's going to be him like dragging my team on his, what, like 36-year-old, 37-year-old back? Is he 36? Whereas the Warriors, really, that's going to be a situation where they didn't play to their talent if they don't make the playoffs. That shouldn't be a team that's on the outside looking in this year based off of the talent on that roster.
Yeah, I would seem to agree. I would say if you're looking at strictly talent and that angle is what you're going with, then Memphis and Golden State should be two teams that are in there, and, you know, Phoenix should be battling it out with Dallas for the overachiever of the year award to make the eighth seed. But in reality, you know, Phoenix is looking up and going, hey, Portland, you're right there. We have the tiebreaker on you this season. You're only a couple of games ahead of us in the standings. We might be able to leapfrog you eventually with the way that we're playing and the way that you're playing. So I think I agree with you on there. If Golden State misses the playoffs, I think it's, I don't know if it's a travesty. Kind of depends on what their record is. If they miss the playoffs and they're like 15 games over 500 and miss it out by a half game because, you know, Memphis just continued playing well, then I guess it's okay to an extent. But I think Golden State's talent dictates a 4-6 seed, not a team that should be thinking about, hey, if we make it or don't make it. I think that Dallas ends up being the team on the outside looking in. My reasoning, though, isn't because Memphis is 13-4 coming into tonight since Marc Gasol has come back. My argument is because Nick Calathes, the former Florida Gator, who I thought was an NBA player right away after college that went and played in Greece for a little while. It's since he was inserted into the starting lineup that they started playing fantastic. So I think it's more Nick Calathes than Marc Gasol, and I think most people in the NBA world understand that. It's Nick Calathes' world, and we're all just kind of living in it.
Well, that makes a lot of sense now that you point that out. You have to excuse my ignorance for not immediately jumping to that conclusion.
You know, a lot of people, you know what, Nick Calathes doesn't get a lot of credit for what Nick Calathes does. He's a phenomenal basketball player and won games at Florida and then went and won games in Greece, and now he's winning games single-handedly all by himself out here in Memphis. Now, the secondary question to that, same reader that sent out this question, so thanks again, Trevor, is, so as sort of a secondary question to that, if you were Phoenix, if you see Phoenix making it, do you think that Eric Bledsoe coming back for the playoff time, if so, will he make a significant contribution? Sorry, I'm reading that at a weird angle, but basically summarizing, if we see Phoenix making the playoffs and Eric Bledsoe makes it back in time, does that make a significant difference in wins and losses in the playoffs for the Suns? I'll let you take that one there, Jim.
It's going to be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out when he returns. Gerald Green has really seemed to flourished as of lately, and I'm not sure whether Bledsoe's return is going to take away some of the touches and the freedom, the liberty that Green's had that's really helped him there. So obviously Bledsoe is going to be a big addition when he comes back, but it's a situation of to what is he going to bring in concert with other players maybe taking a step back. I really don't think Green will perform as well in the role coming off the bench. I think it's a weird situation with him because it seems like he's a very confident player, but it seems like that confidence needs to be kind of goaded, urged to a certain extent. And so when he feels like he doesn't have as long of a leash, then you know it brings him back in a little bit. So I don't know, just something that I kind of sense with him.
Yeah, and
so
it'll
be interesting to see if the Suns actually do something tomorrow to add something, because obviously they have the front court weaknesses. I think, you know, if they can finish, let's say, sixth or seventh, as long as they avoid Oklahoma City in the first round, I don't see why they couldn't play with the Clippers or Portland or San Antonio. So I would think, like, even the way they're playing right now, I would give them definitely a puncher's chance against those teams. So if Bledsoe comes back and the team is playing even better than they are now, then I don't see why they wouldn't have a chance to hang with anybody outside of – I think Oklahoma City is probably going to be another level ahead of the rest of the teams out west.
Yeah, and I'll take it a little bit further, and then we'll get into the second question here. But I was talking to a fellow writer that's with ESPN earlier today, and we basically came to the same conclusion. With a healthy Eric Bledsoe, with a healthy roster in general, I think the Phoenix Suns not only can compete, but I think have the ability to beat every single team that's a playoff contender in the Western Conference outside of Oklahoma City, and I threw San Antonio in there as well, but they've beaten Houston already this year. They are clearly on the same level as everybody else outside of, you know, Houston, San Antonio, and Oklahoma City. But I think that I can see the Suns in a 7-game series knocking off every single playoff team, if fully healthy, outside of those two teams. And then I think that they would have, as you mentioned, the ability to make those nice, long, uncomfortable series for, you know, San Antonio and Oklahoma City. But to go back to the last thing you said there, so this will lead us into the final topic for us and the final question. Do you foresee any major trades prior to the trade deadline here in February? And do you feel it would be best for the team being the Suns, if they stayed the same until the end of the season, so team chemistry isn't disturbed and they have a good shot in free agency? So basically, two-part question. League-wide, do you think this is going to be a busy trade deadline? It's been crickets basically so far. And beyond that, what is your take on whether or not the Suns should even make a move?
Well, we saved the best for last randomly on the show, and I hope the league saved the best for last when we're approaching that deadline tomorrow at I think 3 p.m. Eastern. That'll be noon here, 1 o'clock here. What time would that be?
You said it's 3 o'clock Eastern, so it'd be 1 o'clock out here.
Okay, I'm pretty sure that's when it is, isn't it?
I don't know.
I'll have to edit this out of our conversation if I got that egregiously wrong.
So, no, just let's put it this way. Whatever time it says with the ET or the EST time on it at the bottom of your screen or wherever you're reading, just take 2 hours off of that, guys. That's the difference out here.
Oh, I'm not reading. I was going off of memory, so that's where I went derailed right off the start. But, okay. We've heard a bunch about the Semeca Okafor expiring contract, medically insured deal, that the value of that contract. And so for weeks now, going off of that, there's been speculation that the Suns were going to be able to turn that into something that would help them this year, some kind of valuable asset, since this was regarded as, you know, a very good trade ship. Now, if the Suns don't manage to move that and get a positive return that's going to be a net positive down the line as well as now, I don't think really just like a temporary thing maybe helps them that much, then I'm going to be disappointed. Now, what you have to look at with the team too is that even, like I heard some of these talks of cold, but like with a Pau Gasol situation, something like that, I think something like that would actually cost the Suns like about $10 million or so for the 30-game rental of a player like that, because you're taking on more salary. I think it was something like Emeka's maybe 14, Powell's 19. So you're taking that five back, but then plus you're losing the insured portion of that contract, I believe, is the way it works. So I'm pretty sure something like that would cost the Suns over $10 million. So it's not just as simple as, oh, expiring for expiring. It's the $10 million. So unless you really think something like that's actually going to help the team, then that's a gamble in terms of, I mean, $10 million plus, that's a lot of money. And then also you have speculation in terms of some of these teams, say it's for Gasol, it's for Dang, something else, wanting draft picks too. So now you're giving up all that money plus draft picks for a short-term rental. So I would actually hope the Suns abstain from doing something along those lines. I was always a big fan of the, you know, whole liberate Kevin Love from Minnesota, come play here for Phoenix. But you know, a move like that would make a lot of sense to me. Other than that, I don't think I'd want to give up any draft picks, any real assets for a player rental, especially when you never know how something like that's going to fit into a system. And some of those players listed, I mean, what does Dang give us? It detracts what Gerald Green gives us. I think we're doing fine. I don't know that that's an upgrade. Can Gasol play well in the system? Obviously, we need some of the stuff he can provide, but how does that mix? I mean, there's always a potential that stuff like that could backfire. So it'll be interesting, but based off of everything I've heard, that's actually a possibility, which leads me to believe that Ryan McDonough is back somewhere working on something completely different than anybody's even speculated on. I haven't really been enamored with many of the rumors that I've heard.
Yeah, and I think that to go in a different direction with the Pau Gasol trade, so let's rewind time to about 3-4 years ago. Different time, different front office, different philosophy on how things work. This Phoenix Suns team was around 3-4 years ago, 2-3 years ago even, and they were in a position with this amazing contract that they can trade, and they were in a position to go rent a player that might give them 2 to 3 more home games here in the playoffs, because they're just going to assume that they're going to make the playoffs. You're adding a, you know, semi all-star level player at this stage in his career, a guy that might be able to give you 18-10 or 18-8 on any given night, be a go-to scorer. So maybe you add 2 to 3 more home games. Maybe you get into the second round versus just being a first round exit. that philosophy right there would have been the conversation in the trade room that would have led to sending Emeka Okafor, maybe another player, and a first-round draft pick to the Los Angeles Lakers for Pau Gasol, because the mindset would be dollar signs in the eyes, butts in the seats, and selling out an arena plus concessions plus, you know, memorabilia and things like that for 2 to 3 more games for, you know, versus what they would have had potentially. I don't see that being something that's really brought up. I think if it's brought up, I think that, you know, it gets immediately downplayed and put to the side with the way the new front office is structured, the trust they have with Ryan McDonough and the coaching staff, and even, you know, Lon Babbie and crew. I don't think that there's dollar signs in the eyes. I don't think that Robert Sarver necessarily has that much of an influence, because this is a group that he probably wants to keep together for a while. So I think that you're not going to see the days of, you know, giving away or doing all what they did to get a Kurt Thomas or doing everything they can to get rid of a player because of money reasons and this, that, and a third. I think that whatever move they're going to make is going to be for, quoting David Stern, for basketball reasons. So I think that everything that they do, I was never enamored with the Kevin Love thing. I talked a little bit about him with the MVP stuff. I don't think he impacts winning, but I don't think he's ever played with an all-star level player outside of in an all-star game. So who knows? He might be that amazing piece with Miles Plumlee playing the garbage man and PJ Tucker playing the garbage man and Goran and Eric going out there and playing their two-man game, and you have Kevin Love. That could be a dynamic, phenomenal NBA championship contending team, or it could be a team with, you know, doing the same aspirations of what they have now, because maybe Kevin Love just doesn't impact winning. Maybe he doesn't move that needle. To answer the question about the trades, though, without rambling too much, I don't see it. I mean, unless there's a lot of, you know, secret door meetings and things like that. Most rumors, by the way, are started by agents talking to writers like us. I have agents call me all the time and try and float stuff out to me. It's hard to wade through the crap sometimes with, you know, a little 6-inch paddle. But there's a lot of stuff that's thrown out there. Most trade rumors, when you hear them, if they sound kind of silly or maybe too good to be true, it's probably an agent talking to a writer. Keep that in mind. So with the stuff that we've been hearing, like a little minor trade with Brooklyn and Sacramento, that one going through, you know, Iman Shumpert and Kenneth Faried being the biggest names that are on the market outside of Gasol and Kevin Love, who are both pretty much not really on the market, I don't see this being a big booming trading. I think trade season has gone from late February to draft night. I think that draft night is when big trades happen, and then a couple of nights after draft night when you're able to make trades, that's trade season, in my opinion, is around the draft, around draft picks, around maybe superstars moving teams. I don't think that that's this time of year. Hopefully I'm wrong. Hopefully there's something big and noteworthy and that we can talk about for weeks.
Well, it's definitely better entertainment value when big names move, when stuff happens. It's fun to talk about that kind of stuff. So the buildup up to that, will definitely be kind of unsatisfying if nothing at all happens. The Reggie Evans, Jason Terry thing just doesn't really do it for me. But the way I kind of saw it, and I don't know if you've considered this, so maybe you can give me your thoughts on it, was that since McDonough's been here, he's been able to turn trash into treasure. He's just made some outstanding moves that nobody saw turning out as good as they did. And so that's why we've dubbed him with all these different names, you know, McMiracle, McMidas. He's got a bunch of nicknames. Everybody's really grown fond of him already. So now, given that he was able to do so much with so little, and now he has this Emeka Okafor contract, which is supposed to have so much value, wouldn't it be a little bit, I don't know if upsetting is the right word, but, you know, just not really satisfying that he wasn't able, you know, a guy with all his perspicacity and pertinacity, able to turn this valuable trade chip into something when he was able to do more with less?
Maybe. I mean, I look at the Emeka Okafor thing. I was thinking about this a little bit today and while we were talking. It's almost like when you buy something and then you open it up and then you realize, oh man, there's a mail-in rebate on this too. I spent $500 on this, but if I just make the effort of picking this up, putting it in an envelope, walking to the post office and handing it to somebody, I'm going to get $50 back in a few weeks. This is really only a $450 item that I bought. That's kind of how I see the Emeka Okafor thing. It's one of those things where if you didn't really know how valuable it was going to be because you didn't know how good the team was going to be, you didn't know you had that rebate inside the box of the product that you bought, and a little bit of effort and you can get rid of it very easily. I'm sure there's a lot of different easy ways that he could have dumped off a Mecha Okafor and done something with it. But at the end of the day, if you don't mail out that rebate, you never expected you were going to have it. It was never really impacting your life in any way. Like, Okafor is not really impacting the team. And with the variable of having to draw back and bring back salary, probably in most trade scenarios, I know Gasol's got a unique big contract, but that's kind of how I see it. I see it as more of like, it's, you know, Emeka Okafor is that instant rebate you didn't think you were ever going to get slash need to cash in. Now you have an opportunity to cash it in. So if you don't do it, does that mean that you're not smart or that you're, you know, you're unwise? Or does it just mean that, hey, it was something I didn't really knew existed, and when I had the opportunity to use it, I just kind of forgot about it and declined to use it? That's kind of my take on it.
Right. Yeah, I can understand that. I guess just after the hullabaloo about this possible value, I just kind of assumed that Ryan McDonough is going to do something just absolutely spectacular with it. And sometimes the best plan of action is no action at all. Sometimes it's prudent to just stand pat for a little bit when it makes sense. And like, one of the things, another reason why I didn't like the whole Gasol idea is, like you had said, with the draft and everything there, if the Suns went for Gasol and did that and took on his salary, so then going into that draft, I think they'd only have about $500,000 under the cap instead of $5-plus million under the cap, to where they're still going to be in a very good position to wheel and deal on draft day with the ability to absorb some of that money. Not a whole lot of teams are in that position, and I know that there have been times before where they would have been in a much more enviable position armed with that to have the flexibility to make some moves that prevented them from doing. So that's another way that you can look at this too.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I don't think there's a wrong answer with it. You can probably critique Ryan McDonough a lot right now because you can go, hey, he had nothing and he turned it in. You shouldn't say nothing, but, you know, he had less in his, you know, his deck of cards there when he was able to acquire Eric Bledsoe and when he was able to acquire Plumlee and Green. You know, the drafting of Goodwin has, granted, he's not an all rookie selection guy, but for being the 29th pick, he's played pretty, you know, well for his time on the court. He did a lot with little to nothing, or, you know, a lot with less. Now he has the ability, if he really wanted to turn Miles Plumlee into something, to turn Gerald Green into something, to turn Goran or Eric Bledsoe into something. So, and then the Emeka Okafor contract. So, I mean, yeah, you can definitely take that stance and put your foot down and go, man, he did so much with so little, and now he's armed with about 4 to 5 assets that almost any team would love, and you can draw back and bring back stuff. But you go back to the disturbing chemistry, you go back to dollars and cents versus wins and losses, you go back to the draft night and creating and maintaining flexibility. There's a lot of different reasons why you shouldn't do things, but Ryan McDonough is a maverick and he does what he thinks is right. And, you know, he's been right on pretty much everything he's touched so far. So he's a thief in the night. He might be up all night and creating something and have a trade for us tomorrow that is going to blow our hair back, or he might, you know, step back and do nothing, maybe do some minor tweaks. At the end of the day, I don't think there's really a wrong answer, as long as you maintain your flexibility long term, which he is very conscious of. And as long as you maintain the current team chemistry dynamic, which is part of the reason why they're playing as well as they are. I think those are the main two things to consider outside of, you know, numerous other variables, of course.
I guess part of it is just the way I've built up Ryan McDonough in some of these scenarios, because the way I kind of envision all this stuff happening when he's sitting across the table from another one of these NBA general managers is like the poisoned drink scene in The Princess Bride, shout out to that movie, between Wesley and Vizzini there, where the other general manager is just going through all these mental gymnastics to figure out how he's going to get over on Ryan McDonough, and Ryan McDonough is sitting there very calmly knowing that he's already got this guy right under his thumb the whole time. So that's the high standard that I'm holding him up to, and so I always expect him to do good. So I guess if nothing happens and it's a quiet as the center of the storm there, then I'll just have to trust that was the best move for him to make, was to stand pat and wait.
So basically what I'm getting out of you is that you, when you envision Ryan McDonough in his office, where he's probably just wearing just a nice suit and sitting at his desk and talking on the phone, but what you're envisioning is a gigantic, elaborate meth lab with him wearing a bowler hat and a chemistry suit and basically going all Breaking Bad. I know you don't get the reference, Jim, because you don't have enough time to sit down and watch it, but everybody listening is going to get it. You kind of picture him with the bowler hat at the table with gangsters and outsmarting them, despite being some 50-year-old, you know, suburban teacher that has no business being at the table with gangsters. That's kind of how you're picturing him. You have this remarkable perception of him as just being this dynamic character that's going to outsmart, outwit, and outdo everybody. It's going to be great for comic books, but I think Ryan McDonough is more of the sitting in his suit at his desk with his phone and taking calls and, you know, kind of that normal boring stuff that you see more in like a Boiler Room and things like that. He's not Heisenberg. This is not Breaking Bad, I think.
There's probably something mystical, magical back there behind the scenes. It's Jedi mind tricks, maybe.
All right, I'm not going to take away your fantasy. I'm going to let you keep perceiving that as a reality. I apologize for that. Santa is real. Easter is around the corner, and the bunny will be laying eggs in your yard. I apologize, folks. I don't want to be the guy that ruins dreams and perception. So that might be the case. Ryan McDonough might have one of those amazing bookcases where he, you know, hits a couple of keys on the keyboard, it turns around, and he's got his giant dungeon of doom that he brings other general managers into and makes them go through mental jumping jacks while he's laughing in his head.
Well, exactly. McDonough sends text messages just like you and I, but when he sends text messages, he's swindling other NBA general managers out of their players and assets.
Exactly. Yeah, and when he sends text messages, it's in a different font, it's in a different size, and it reads differently. That's just the kind of man that Ryan McDonough is. So I'm gonna let you go ahead and give the Brightsiders the last word here. I know we've been gone for a little while, so I wanted to run long and have, you know, a two-parter and get a lot of takes and a lot of talk going on here. But also, there's not that much time between when folks are going to press play and the trade deadline is going to actually happen. So, Jim, go ahead and leave us with your parting thoughts on whatever you want to be. There's a myriad of topics, from the All-Star game to Gorin, the trade deadline, all kinds of stuff. So what are your final thoughts?
Yeah, I'm just really looking forward to the rest of the season. I've really had a lot of fun. This team has been growing on me the whole year. I know it has with a lot of our loyal fans. I think that the rest of the general public is really missing out. And so even though I think they're late to the party, hopefully they get there eventually. And, yeah, you just can't wait to see what the future brings. I hope Bledsoe gets back healthy, and waiting to see how the Suns navigate this next week here. They got some tough games, and this race for the final playoff spots is going to be a lot of fun.
Absolutely, and you already got our takes on who's going to make it and on a lot of different things. So thanks for listening in on two parts of the podcast here. We're going to be back more on a weekly basis going forward. Hiatus is my fault. Don't blame anybody else. So we'll be back next week with episode 52 after you just went through 51 and 51 and a half. Maybe we'll have 51 and three quarters if something amazing happens. We'll have something else for you on Friday. But beyond that, folks, enjoy the rest of your day. Enjoy the trade deadline madness, and we'll be back next week.